Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. The novel that put author James Joyce on the map in 1916 was A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It's the classic coming-of-age tale about a young, intellectually curious boy who slowly awakens to the world around him. As he's exposed to different ideas, he starts to question everything he's ever been taught and begins to construct a new life for himself, with a new sense of opportunity. It's one of the most inspiring books kids are required to read in high school. At least I hope they're still required to read it. What a shame if they were to miss out on the adventures of Stephen Dedalus, the protagonist of the book. Truth be told, we're all Stephen Dedaluses in our own way. We all have to come to terms with the way we were raised, with the things we were taught, and have to decide what to keep and what to discard. For most of us, I think it's safe to say that the transition is slow, gradual. For others, it can be violent, wrenching. It all depends what you have to learn and what you have to fight. In today's program, producer Askia Muhammad tells us about his own journey from green young student to politically aware adult. His story begins in the 1960s and is called My World, Officer Candidate School.
Inside, I feel like I'm the same person I've always been. On the outside, it's hard to recognize that I was once Charles K. Moreland, Jr., Officer Candidate, U.S. Naval Reserve, Kilo Company 711, summer 1967. I'm complex. I'm a photojournalist, poet, radio producer, reporter, a middle-aged hack in the twilight of a mediocre career, at best. But back then, I was less a cynic. I believed. The Navy appealed to me in my innocence, my age of discovery and doo-wop music. Boys like me from single-parent homes got our manhood experience in one of two places, the military or the penitentiary. Becoming a naval officer would be my bootstrap.
Okay, you want to see the breakers next?
For the first time in nearly 40 years, I went back to Newport, Rhode Island to search for my life's purpose as it was then. In 1967, my life was all about the meritocracy, the naval school, when I thought maybe race did not matter. I did find R.J., a cab driver in Newport, and he helped me put Newport's racial identity in its long historical perspective.
How many mansions are here?
There's over 500. A mansion is 13 rooms and servants. Today, caretakers. Now, you see the bricks on this building over here? This was built around 1800. Those bricks were English ballast brick. And there's only one way the English ballast brick came here, was in the bottom of the slave ships. So they put the bricks in there to keep the ships from tipping over. See how beautifully, though, that this workmanship...
The taxi I took is one tour of Newport, but there's another side to Newport. If you only go to the big houses, you don't see this other side of town. I decided maybe I could find some perspective there.
But they had to work, you see. They had to work for the rich people in order to get themselves in. And, of course, the rich would have their enormous parties. They would deliver ice to these parties. So what a learning experience this was. And many of the people who lived in Newport would come because they expected so much here but didn't see the other side of town. When they got here, they were in for a big surprise because they had to live in the barracks.
The Martin Luther King Center in Newport was once a social center for black soldiers. The King Center is the meeting site for a group which now calls itself Recycled Teenagers. They are 70, 80, 90-year-olds. They've seen the royalty and the super rich come and go to Newport from the other side of town. When I was in Newport in 67, I could never have even envisioned that there were people like Mrs. James and Mrs. Keyes living there. Born Newporters, some of whose parents were born Newporters. Black people who made important achievements in naval history, often in spite of the Navy.
And
Now, when my husband came to Newport, I guess it was maybe 1942, they weren't prepared for African-American sailors in Newport. And then my husband spent 39 years in the reserves. And, of course, what he was doing there, well, he says, I'm not going to do this all my life, be washing toilets for these officers and washing their socks and things. And so it wasn't easy for these young servicemen in Newport.
Wow. And I did a survey of the barracks. I could not believe the people that were fighting for our country had to live like this. They shouldn't have to go through all this and this prejudice in this town and this prejudice with the Navy.
Of course, I didn't know anything about that when I got to Newport in 1967.
That's the Tennis Hall of Fame.
It's the Tennis Hall of Fame, just right up the street.
When I arrived on the bus, ghetto kid, among all the other things I had with me was a tennis racket. I'm going to boot camp. But I thought I was a patrician. A patrician to be.
Why not? You had the brain for it.
Gate 10 here at the U.S. Naval Station Newport is the entrance to Coddington Point, where the Officer Candidate School was located. I really can't remember anything about my trip from California until we arrived at the processing center just inside Gate 10. There I was, sitting in the back of the bus. I had my straw hat, my Madras shirt. I even brought a tennis racket, thinking I was headed to Newport, a country club town. So when we arrived, me and the world thinking I'm headed to the land of milk and honey, someone I don't know, all I remember are his words. Put your orders and your orders only in your right hand and all your other possessions in your left hand and double time. Well, I had a tennis racket, a little suitcase. I had, of course, a big envelope with orders. He can't be serious. I can't carry all this stuff in one hand. I was tarrying, trying to collect myself, at which point he got in my face and said again, I said, put your orders and your orders only in your right hand and all your other possessions in your left hand and double time, mister. That's when my eyes were opened for the first time in Newport, Rhode Island.
Company! Right turn! March!
I'd been in the Navy Reserve for 4 years, soon after I graduated from high school in Los Angeles. I was fully engaged in the all-too-typical downward spiral, flunking out of college, trying to avoid spinning out altogether. I was an only child. My mother was a hard-of-hearing single mom who controlled me with an iron fist. I had no social life, and I blamed my mother. My high school buddy Clint Wilson, though, was an anchor. Clint was a year ahead of me. While I may have been having my ups and downs, Clint was Mr. Stability. Clint grew up well-grounded, and at the end of the day, some of his bottom-line reasons for joining the Navy had become my own.
So I had been told that if you ever go into the military service, it must be in the Navy because you'll find yourself at least on a ship, and during battle, the cooks will still be there to prepare your meals, and barring that your ship gets sunk, you should survive pretty well. And that appealed to me as opposed to being in the Army or the Marine Corps or something like that.
You know, we hung out like brothers.
I didn't go on
active duty. He was an only child and I was an only child. Our relationship grew around just being just buddies. I still have my high school yearbooks, except for my junior year, his graduation year, because he didn't buy it and I gave him mine, so he would at least have one for his graduation year. So, I mean, that's sort of how close we were. We were just, I would give him the shirt off my back.
young ladies that I knew at the time did not think ill of me, we'll say, for being a man in uniform, and I
took advantage of your appearance and the bell bottoms and the hat.
Yes, and when I was away at boot camp,
neither of us were ladies' men. You would say we didn't have lots and lots of girlfriends the way the ghetto myth goes, and we weren't great dancers. So having a little extra something going, like being in uniform, was not a bad thing. Okay, so you were discharged in 1967.
Well,
I
completed the active duty in 1967, but at that time, of course, I got my degree was at hand, so I got a commission, and I became the first black public affairs officer in the Navy.
I saw it as
I never spent active duty
a chance
time
to become the man.
Officer, but
I saw it as my step up out of inner city life, out of obscurity, into the upper level of society. I was going to become an officer and a gentleman.
You're a thousand miles away, but I still...
My whole family always said they thought I would be a preacher. Military service was not in my family's DNA. I remember talking about it once to my mother's brother, Uncle Forrest Canterbury from Indianola, Mississippi. Had he ever been in the service, I asked him. Oh, sure. I was in church service last Sunday. No, I insisted. I mean the Army. Were you ever in the Army? Yes, Salvation Army. When I met Uncle Darius, my father's youngest brother, he was an authentic bohemian intellectual who had bongo drums in his apartment and something of a discernible aversion to military authority.
I respect the drum, and I play congas. I don't play bongos anymore. It takes too much energy. But if there's anything political involved there, it is that the drum represents freedom, and the experience of our slave ancestors did not represent freedom, and they were denied freedom. And any political position in any country, United States, any place else, that denies freedom to its people or denies freedom to anybody is a policy that I cannot accept.
You know, I was 12 years old or so and feeling very awkward and mostly in awe of you, who seemed like an uncle, but more like a distant older brother.
Mm-hmm.
The whole apartment thing, bongos in your apartment, Zen books, teaching me how to play chess. I mean, things like that that were esoteric. But I wonder, what was I like?
Oh, you were a very quiet, very polite, very nice young man, willing to help and very helpful to my mother.
As I recall, I used to work in your father's garden.
My father was a Baptist minister. Among the things that my father taught was not to trust the establishment. And the establishment was a racial establishment. The establishment were white people. So I had a problem with that because I knew some white people and they didn't appear to be evil to me. So there was a conflict for me. Oh, one other thing.
I think there was a lot of anger
that everyone
at the time of the Watts riot, a lot of resentment of police brutality, and it was common that people who got arrested would relate that they would get beaten up with a rubber hose in the basement of the police station and then put back out on the street. That was their sentence. That was their punishment. They never went to court.
During that year, with the kids who were locked up in the Watts riots, a lot of kids, most of them black, had been thrown into juvenile hall.
I was having none of that. 2 years after Watts in 1967, Newport was my fairy tale destination. And besides, Watts was behind us. What I didn't see then was that what happened in Watts and other big cities during the long, hot summers of urban riots in the 1960s also had an effect in places like Newport.
This building here, wow, before it became the Martin Luther King Center, was the USO.
Yeah, I've got
this
pictures,
building
yeah.
was the place that entertained the black sailors,
yes,
that came to Newport. When this building closed, we went to the big one on Washington Square. We were not really graciously accepted, but we were accepted. People born and bred in Newport didn't accept this. They were standoffish, which I understood that, too. This is a time where we weren't graciously accepted anyway, you know.
By midsummer 1967, I was beginning to pick up on not being fully accepted at OCS, and I began looking for the black community. I ended up at Hurley's Bar.
I heard you mention Hurley's Lounge. Well, I was the bartender there. And we opened that place in 1961.
Yes, we know where Hurley's Bar is. That was the place where the police and firemen and bartenders and waitresses and musicians would go after they finished their jobs.
This is Sardella's restaurant. In the 1960s, it was Hurley's Bar. African Americans knew that this was the place to come for entertainment. This is where my second Newport epiphany took place. It was inside Hurley's Bar in the summer of 1967 where I heard that the riots, which were spreading all over urban America, had come to Providence, Rhode Island, just 17 miles away. And I felt, for the first time, embarrassment that I was wearing the U.S. Navy uniform. The song which rings in my mind, which I know I didn't hear here, was San Francisco. Scott McKenzie sang it, and it reminded me of home. If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. I wasn't a hippie, I was a U.S. Naval officer candidate, but maybe it was the combination of riot in Providence and flower power that just really changed me for good here in Newport. In the streets of San Francisco, gentle people with flowers in their hair. Back at college, after that summer was over, I was transforming from Negro to black. Professor Vulanlela Wabogo teaches black studies at San Francisco City College. In 1967, at San Jose State, he taught chemistry and was a studious, hardcore intellectual and jazz pianist. Black campus activism was coming to a boil, and Professor Wabogo was one of its strategists.
On the campus, it was very obvious that every class we went to was, in fact, a study of Europe. So the militants at San Jose State was related to the idea that we had to have something in academia that addressed us.
Now, what was I like at San Jose State?
Well, how I saw you was this. Suffice to say, I saw myself as a full-fledged revolutionary changing the world order. And you, I saw you as a person with tremendous talents, intellect, and principles. And you already were beginning to change. You may not have perceived it, but we perceived it. I think you were in the officer's school. Let's see. Were you a naval officer?
I was in the Navy Reserve.
Yeah, Naval Reserve. Yes, you were. And that's the military. That's the military that's going overseas and invading countries. That's how we saw them. And just like in that book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, I said, our struggle has got to be broader, and we can't just limit it to the people who are going to be criticizing and raising hell and doing the radical things. And I saw you as having that potential because you were already leaning in that direction. You were beginning to question things. You were beginning to ask questions about things. And I said, I must help this young man in his journey toward his African consciousness and to becoming a full-fledged member of the thrust to break down the shackles of racism and oppression and so on.
It was also at San Jose State that I heard Stokely Carmichael, leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee,
SNCC. And we begged the president, We beg the federal government. That's all we've been doing, begging, begging. It's time we stand up and take over.
He spoke and said things that people my age were feeling and wanting to hear said. And he was articulate, he was intelligent, and he was the leader of a group of students who had really risked all in order to achieve civil rights progress.
Everybody, what do you want? That's what we're gonna get.
My father and my mother were never married, and I didn't know about that until my mother's death. My father was present in Los Angeles, and he was a barber. He was known throughout the black pool checker world as a real master of pool checkers. He wrote books on checkers, but he and I weren't close. And I would get my hair cut from him every other week, and my mother would always tell me, make sure you get some money from him, because that was also part of my father's reputation as being sort of stingy. But I didn't know him and didn't know that. All I knew of him was this guy I would go and see in the barbershop, and he would give me money for ice cream on Sundays, and that was it. I knew Darius better, and perhaps Darius was a substitute. I didn't have any brothers. Clint perhaps was part of that substitute male figure role model that I needed and never had. And the Navy was a part of that, was finding manhood in a constructive way.
Company, right turn, march.
You know, I want to know why you didn't finish that school over there.
The reason, and this gets right to Martin Luther King Jr., when I was scheduled to come back right after the assassination of Dr. King, Newsweek magazine offered internships to all African Americans. All of their interns that year, all 12, were African American, and I was offered an internship at Newsweek. It was a difficult decision, but I mean, and as things had begun to change when there was a riot 17 miles from where I was, that was the beginning of where I started to change. And then when someone said, do you want to work with Newsweek? And the Navy said, you got to go back to Newport or resign from OCS. I decided.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, yeah. Because I was interested in you know, just thank why. You. Yeah, well, I can understand that, because maybe that's the only chance you get. You don't know.
Although there would be many chapters yet to be performed, it was here at Howard University's Crampton Auditorium in November 1968 where I crossed the point of no return. Instead of the man, the patrician I thought I was going to become by way of OCS the summer before, by November 1968, I had become the opposite in terms of the two ideals at war in my soul. Am I black or am I American? My internship at Newsweek's Los Angeles Bureau the summer after the King assassination exposed me to black militant writers and thinkers. Quincy Troop, Louise Merriweather, Hoyt Fuller, members of the Black Panther Party. By September, I was a completely different C.K. Moreland Jr. It was also a different America. Robert Kennedy had been killed just 2 months after Dr. King. The words, Black Power, were on the lips of people everywhere. It seemed the second American Revolution was going to start any day. Stokely Carmichael had just spoken at San Jose State.
So much strength in building our community that if they come to get one person, they're going to have to mess with us all. That's what we got to do. That's what we got to do.
I had developed a deep affection for Stokely even before I met him because of Miss Lorna Smith, an 89-year-old white San Jose resident who had spent a summer in Mississippi with him. She then collected all things Carmichael for a half dozen scrapbooks that she donated to the Stanford University Library. He returned my affection.
After his speech, he put a wad of money into my hand, $200, maybe $300, and told me about a conference at Howard University that weekend. It was called Toward a Black University, and he wanted me to attend. I was in. I had been recruited to join the vanguard of the movement by its first field marshal. Remember, Stokely warned, if you're used by the man, you're useless to the people. I must have caught the next plane. I arrived in Washington wearing a dashiki, an African-styled short-sleeved shirt, and the pea coat from my Navy enlisted uniform. So here I was, Saturday night at Crampton Auditorium. I was on stage with Leroy Jones, Larry Neal, Sonia Sanchez, Don Lee.
Now, when I hear Billy's soft, soulful sighs of Am I Blue, I say, no, sweet Billy, no more.
I was to read a poem during the student section of the program. It was just about my turn for the denunciation of the tyrants and to rejoice boasted liberties when I realized it was my Navy Reserve weekend. Oops, I was AWOL. I knew immediately. No longer an officer candidate, I had no more college deferments, and missing another monthly drill like I was that weekend meant I was soon to be ordered into the fleet for my 2 years of active duty. Stokely's words rang in my head. If you're used by the man, you're useless to the people. I could not serve on active duty. The Viet Cong had never called me out of my name. At that moment, I didn't know if I would flee to Canada or end up in jail, but right here, right then, I knew I had to do something, though, because I knew I had crossed over. There could be no turning back.
My World, Officer Candidate School, was produced by Askia Muhammad, with field production by Katie Gott. Special thanks to Mr. Jackson, Mrs. James, Mrs. Somerville, and Mrs. Eleanor Keys of Newport. The show is mixed by Jared Weisbrot. This program airs as part of My World, a collaboration with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's program, Out Front, and editor Neil Sandel. The series aired with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. You can visit us anytime you'd like online at soundprint.org. In addition to the listening links for our weekly program and all of our archived past programs, check out our resource links and special series. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Did you enjoy today's episode? Tell us what you're thinking and where you're listening from. Drop us a line via our email address, talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint episodes can be purchased. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES and we'll mail out your favorites. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.